right, we'll proceed now in the matter of Fair v. Bakhtiari and hear first from Mr. Schartz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, the supplemental brief by plaintiff Tom Fair provides us with a perfect example of how easy it is to comply with the bright line test of Evidence Code Section 1123. In that case, the parties signed a document in mediation that was entitled Confirmation of Settlement as a Result of Mediation. The document went on to say that the plaintiffs and the defendants herein agree they have reached a full and final settlement of the claims. There was even added a concluding paragraph, and that paragraph said, the parties intend that this settlement is enforceable pursuant to the provisions of Code of Civil Procedure Section 664.6. The parties agree that this confirmation of settlement is exempt from the confidentiality provisions of Evidence Code Section 1152 et sec. Close quote.
Do you feel, though, you spoke of a bright line that 1123 of the Evidence Code sub B does provide a bright line by using the words enforceable or binding or words to that effect?
I think that's clear, Your Honor, that it does. I think the legislature was concerned with excessive formality with what parties might do in a mediation, but recognized that common English, language that a client could even understand, could easily be done by lawyers of normal skill and competency. The statute is clear that you need to say words that mean, clearly, either the document is disclosable or that it is an agreement that is binding and enforceable or final, or words to that effect. It's not a very complicated set of language, and as I just read, parties could easily do that, as the Preston case shows.
To put this case in context, reference has been made to this particular part of the evidence code, which prohibits a document that was prepared in the course of mediation to be admitted in evidence, and it prohibits it from discovery. Of course, we know there is an exception. And another part of the evidence code says that, well, there is an exception when, one, there is a written settlement agreement, two, signed by the parties, three, and it provides, I'm quoting, that it is enforceable or binding or words to that effect. And naturally, I realize that here the fight is about the quoted language that is quoted. Whether here the signed agreement had words or to that effect. My question to you is, I reeled off three requirements. Number one, a written settlement agreement. And yes, there is no dispute that here the agreement was signed by all parties. I think after 2 days of mediation, plaintiffs, I gather, prepared what is considered a settlement agreement signed by everyone. So, and in that document, there is the statement that any disputes were to be subject to arbitration. Several days after the signing of this particular agreement, your side repudiated the signed document. And we know that in the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal took a look at the arbitration provision that was included and said, yeah, that does meet the statute, because anyone, according to the Court of Appeal, can figure out that when you say that disputes are subject to arbitration, of course that means that the arbitrator will have a binding decision, and naturally, according to the Court of Appeal, this falls under the statutory requirement that the agreement provides that it's enforceable or binding of words to that effect. And I'm sorry for having such a lengthy introduction, but do we even get to what I consider the more difficult part?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do we even get to that third requirement? At this point, at oral argument, I'm focusing on the first requirement, a written settlement agreement. And as I recall the record, the trial court said there was no written settlement agreement, and the term used by the trial court said the document is just a, quote, term sheet, which I presume suggests the trial court found that it was not a binding contract. So before you focus on what seems to have been the fight in the Court of Appeal and now before us, what about that first requirement that there is a written settlement agreement given the finding by the court based upon, I think, disputed evidence that was presented to the trial court that this was not a binding agreement but simply a term sheet?
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of questions in there. First, it is not a settlement agreement. It doesn't say it's a settlement agreement. It doesn't even have the word agreement in it. It is a term sheet. Second, in order for any writing that a party claims is a settlement agreement to be admissible, it must comply with 1123A or 1123B. There's also 1122, which talks about writings. Very careful steps that parties must take if they intend to waive their right to confidentiality. Third, and this is an important point, a lot of things happen in mediation. We have no idea, and because of the statute, can never have an idea, that there may have been 30 terms that these parties were dealing with. And what they did was they wrote down the first 9 on the way to reaching a settlement. The plaintiffs grabbed those first 9, ran into court, and said, well, there's enough here to prove an agreement, and therefore we have it. At the same time, we are not entitled to inquire that in the mediation itself there may have been another 9 terms. So that's why 1123 says, when you're done, say so. Say so by saying it's binding, it's enforceable, or it's admissible, because we don't know what else happened in the mediation, and we can't find out.
Do they have to say it's binding, enforceable, or admissible, and that's it? Those are the magic words?
No, they're not magic words, Your Honor. They have to, in our view, and I think the standard should be, unambiguously indicate words to those effect.
Right. Now, you suggest that there might have been 18 terms that the parties were negotiating over. Would it be acceptable and cognizable under the law for the parties in mediation to have a partial settlement where they agree on 9 terms, and if they were to use words that expressly indicated that they chose to be bound by those 9, that they could continue in mediation but recognize they had a partial verdict, if you
Absolutely.
Will, and this one's being etched in stone?
Absolutely. You can partially settle any case.
Right.
But you say so, and it also has the words, we agree, or this is final, or this is a partial settlement. You
right.
see that.
And I acknowledge that the statute requires something more than simply a signature of parties, because the statute says so. But to term this a term sheet that could just have been a working document seems to run counter to the notion that all parties signed it and the mediator signed it. Isn't that an indication from the form of the document that it's not just kind of a working act in progress?
Your Honor, I don't think so. That's how term sheets are done in mediation. Mediation is a wild and woolly process.
Yes.
All kinds of crazy things happen. And what the mediator is attempting to do is to move the process along. He wants to get down the preliminary views any way he or she can. Then they're at least at some step forward, they move on. One of the critical things about mediation is that a good mediator settles the easy things first to begin to get a sense of full agreement, and the tough things later. And again, with the restrictions placed by the evidence code, you never know whether the tough things have gotten there. That's the risk of this situation. If I can give you my favorite hypothetical, which is we have a term sheet that says 2 things on it. One, the parties give mutual releases, never want to deal with each other ever again, which is full consideration for an agreement. Term two, the parties will arbitrate any dispute about these mutual releases. Now, there may have been a dozen other terms, including real money, that never gets on the term sheet. A party who is going to have to pay money can run into court and say, I've got a complete agreement. Just look at the face of it. It's got mutual consideration. Both parties have reached mutual consideration. They're walking away. And it has a dispute resolution provision in it. We're done. It is a complete agreement. We need not inquire beyond that. That's the risk that you're entitled, the parties are entitled to fulfill the whole mediation and say so in plain English.
So one of the dangers that you are counseling against is us using the mention of arbitration in this case as a basis for the divination of a final agreement. And you would suggest that the statute requires that there be a specific statement of some kind in words to the effect, this is binding, this is enforceable, this is admissible, we agree to this much.
Right. Something that a client could understand. God forbid, you know, that the layman would read this and say, I know what I'm signing. But on the same point, the Court of Appeal said, and I clearly disagree, that the inclusion of the arbitration provision solely meant the parties intended it to be final, binding, and enforceable. Well, the inclusion of an arbitration provision meant that when they finally came to a final agreement, they would have an arbitration provision in the agreement. And then the arbitrator would go resolve disputes that may arise later. It doesn't automatically mean any more than a form selection clause. What if the parties had said, we agree that the Superior Court in San Francisco will hear any disputes? Would a layman or even a lawyer conclude that that was language that we have an agreement that's binding and enforceable and admissible? No, it's a form selection clause.
And it anticipates that there may not be anything to arbitrate in the end.
Correct.
Isn't that correct?
There may be nothing to arbitrate. They're very commonplace now. And the difficulty is, if the appellate court is upheld and we determine that an arbitration provision means an agreement is final and binding, two things are going to happen. One, I don't think any good lawyers will ever put an arbitration provision in a preliminary agreement or a term sheet or an oral discussion.
But here the document didn't say, wasn't labeled tentative agreement or preliminary agreement or whatever. As I recall, the document was headed in terms of, quote, supplement terms.
Correct.
And as I pointed out earlier, not only did the opposing side sign it, but so did your side. And what comes to mind is just an observation that I have in the course of oral argument. If, as you say, the document that was labeled supplement terms was very preliminary, then why did you bother signing it?
Well, Your Honor, 1123 contemplates as a threshold matter that things get signed in mediation. It says so. It knows things get signed.
And even a document that is still a rough draft or a proposal?
Sure. Let me give you a practical example. It's in the declaration.
Well, before you go
further,
just one more question. As I recall, after the plaintiffs had prepared the settlement terms document, gave it to you, I mean, to your side, was there ever any objection raised by your side to plaintiffs, by the way, we cannot agree with this, et cetera, et cetera, but I think instead your side simply signed off?
Well, you're asking a question, was there a disagreement with the term sheet? The answer was they had gotten that far in the negotiation.
When you signed, as I recall, your side had no problem with any of the terms. I think it was only after your side had signed that disputes arose and you and the other side couldn't agree. Then the plaintiff said, oh, by the way, we have this provision in this document that is labeled settlement terms, and we agreed that any disputes that were to arise would have to be solved by arbitration.
Let me answer the question this way with the example I was going to give. The individuals here were real estate people. it was their practice, as they said under oath in the trial court, to sign letters of intent and term sheets. They did that as a regular basis, which happens regularly in real estate transactions. No one would say that a letter of intent or a term sheet signed by the parties in a real estate transaction binds the parties.
Are you saying that the phrase term sheet or settlement terms is a term of art that is commonly understood in these types of negotiations and mediation?
Oh, I think term sheet is a very commonly understood phrase.
And absolutely. Is it typical in a situation like this that the parties understand that the lawyers, respectively, are going to go back to their offices and write very detailed agreements and terms that they're going to finalize?
Well, let me actually take that's an important question and talk about what happens in mediation. You know, mediation is a mysterious process. We have, you know, students here from high school. I wonder if they understand what we're talking about, because if you haven't been through it, it's difficult to understand. It is absolutely the same for the parties. They have some serious dispute. They're all nervous. They're sitting there. They're in separate rooms. They don't know what goes on. A mediator comes in and talks to them and leaves. It is a mysterious process. There is no question about it. And to expect those individuals whose rights are being affected to understand completely what it is, to understand that when they're signing something that doesn't say agreement and doesn't say it's disclosable and doesn't say it's binding, that they would somehow say, well, you know, there's this dispute resolution clause here. When I sign this, that means I have just signed away everything that I'm in the middle of negotiating. That's what this case stands for. The litigants, which is what this is all about, are entitled to know what's going on and where they stand, because it is their rights that are affected, not the lawyer's rights.
So, Mr. Schartz, just the fact.
Excuse me, I just want to clarify point of not law, but practice. You touched on this before. Justice Kennard was asking, why, if this is all intermediary and in flux, does there come a time that things need to be signed?
Well, let me answer that.
Yeah, I think you might have, but again, for my
Let me answer it. The mediator is just trying to move people along, and the mediator has a lot of techniques. One technique, as I said, is to say, let's start by agreeing what we can agree on, and may pick the easiest terms. The next is to say, look, we've worked for 2 days here. We've made a lot of progress. Let's write it down so we don't forget it. We've got some momentum, because momentum is everything in settling cases. However, you can get to the very end, and finally parties say, now that I see the whole thing, I don't like it.
So you wouldn't revisit the initial terms or the partial terms?
Generally not.
All right.
Generally not. Although, in the end, somebody might say, okay, now I'm looking at the whole deal. Now that I see all the pieces, I'm uncomfortable with that. And we all know that at the end, people negotiate things or renegotiate things. But this is part of the momentum of starting with no agreement and building up an agreement and going through some formality of getting the parties to sign on. And that's what this is. That's what a letter of intent does. That's what a term sheet does. Your Honor, I think I'm at my time.
You have 2 minutes left, assuming you wish to reserve 10 minutes.
I've reserved 10. I'll be happy to take one more question so I don't wind up overstaying
my welcome.
I
do have a question that I wanted to ask.
Yes.
So it's your view that the thoroughness of the document that's being signed, the fact that it covers virtually every issue in dispute, in and of itself is not sufficient to constitute a binding agreement. Is that correct?
Correct, because then what we're doing is we're applying common law contractual interpretation practices to a statute which doesn't say, look at the pre-mediation activity, look at the document, look at the post-mediation activity.
So the legislature has, in a sense, made this judgment call that unless there are words to the effect that this is a binding agreement, the parties to a mediation can sign it, can take it home and sleep on it, and then ultimately decide whether or not, perhaps after consulting with others, whether or not this is something they want to make into a binding agreement. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. And the Ryan case talks about judicial sifting. That is, the trial court should not be subject to trying to read the tea leaves of all these pieces to figure out what the parties really meant, that there is a bright line and a standard that the statute sets forth. Your Honor, I reserve my last 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Schartz. We'll hear now from Mr. Sirota.
Good morning. Gilbert Sirota for Mr. Fair. In the questions that the court was asking Mr. Schartzis during his argument, you were encouraging him to speculate about what might or might not have been terms that were left unexpressed or things that might have happened or the concept of a mediator moving the parties forward toward a settlement but not reaching a settlement. None of that is in the record as fact. What is in the record as fact is representations on the record to the court that the case had settled, and they were unequivocal. The statement written in writing to the Superior Court on April 8th, just a couple of weeks after the mediation, on behalf of Mary Ann Fair, says as follows. After 2 days of mediation, the case has settled.
Mr. Cerullo,
period.
The Court of Appeal did not rely on that, did it? Did the Court of Appeal not rely on the fact
that the Court of Appeal did rely on
disputes were going to be subject to arbitration, and that that phrase was binding words to the effect that the agreement is enforceable?
No, that part had to do with the enforceability of the agreement and not the question of whether the arbitration clause stood for words to that effect. The reason I wanted to bring this up is the court need not engage in speculation about whether the settlement terms were the settlement terms, because counsel for the petitioners represented in writing and in court. Charles Dyer, who represented Bakhtiari on April 17th, went to the Superior Court for a trial-setting conference. And he asked for a delay in the trial-setting conference and for a stay of discovery. And what did he tell the trial judge? He said, and I quote, "Your Honor, this matter was mediated on March the 20th and 21st. We've reached a settlement agreement." Okay? So we don't need to speculate about whether the settlement terms were partial or whether Judge Lynch was leading us down the road.
But wasn't there something more to the communication?
Yes.
Didn't the attorney say, "We are now in the process of exchanging settlement agreements"?
Absolutely.
And there are some complicated tax matters involved?
Yes. And that was
Doesn't
part...
Doesn't that infer that there are matters yet to be resolved?
Yes, but they were not material, because in the settlement terms agreement, if you look at paragraph 8...
It seems to me they're pretty material when the parties at the end say, "No, we don't agree."
That's correct. And if they don't agree, the agreement stands on its own and the tax consequences apply. And that's because of paragraph 8 in the settlement terms agreement.
Mr. Sarota, before you go into what you want to pursue, I have questions that I think I'm struggling with, and I've explored some of these questions with opposing counsel. And as I mentioned at the outset, taking a look at the law in question, there are three requirements: a written settlement agreement, number two, signed by the parties, and then we get to what has been the fight here. What's the magic term? The agreement must provide that it is enforceable or binding or worth to the effect.
Right.
You won on that third factor in the Court of Appeal, right?
Yes, we won on all three factors. There was a settlement agreement. It was signed by all the parties.
Yes, of course, you would agree that you won in all three. But this is what I'm struggling with. Number three, yes, the Court of Appeal concluded that because of the inclusion of the statement in this document that said disputes must be presented to an arbitrator. And the Court of Appeal concluded that the very inclusion of that arbitration provision meant that any decision by the arbitrator was binding upon the parties, et cetera, et cetera. And as we know, the opposing side, after signing the document in question, said, "Oh, by the way, we have problems, and it's unenforceable, blah, blah, blah." At first blush, the Court of Appeal, and this is just a personal expression, our view of mine, at first blush, the Court of Appeal, I think, may have been right in agreeing on the third term. Where I need help from you and I ask that question from the opposing side too, what about that first requirement that there has to be a written settlement agreement? Because, and you, I'm sure you must have heard my question to the opposing side, and I haven't heard anything from you in response to the issue that I've been struggling with. The trial court expressly found that as to the first requirement, there was no written settlement agreement. And I think the term or the phrase that the trial court used was, all we have here is a term sheet. And opposing counsel, in response to questioning from the bench, said, a term sheet, when I asked, well, why would you put your signature to something that's tentative? And if I remember correctly, the answer was, things like term sheets are commonly used by real estate people, and a term sheet is not something that would be considered a real settlement agreement. And what about the finding of the trial court that this was just a term sheet? And as I mentioned, that finding by the trial court came only after consideration of the trial court by disputed evidence. Looking at rules that apply to us, it would at first blush appear that this court would be bound by that finding by the trial court. So how do you get around that?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, the finding by the trial court was a finding of law on admissibility applying 1123B. It was not a factual finding.
And it was not?
And it was not a factual.
When you said one thing and the party said, no, that's not our understanding of what occurred. Trial court, this is what occurred, blah, 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 blah. It would appear to me that these are factual determinations and not, as you are arguing to the court, an issue of law.
There are a couple of issues here. The petitioners, after their attorneys represented that there was an agreement, changed their mind. And they then submitted declarations that said, we subjectively didn't believe this to be a settlement agreement. Subjective intent expressed so far afterward is irrelevant, number one. And number two, we had competing declarations. There wasn't a credibility issue. It was an inferential determination that, as I understand, the Parsons case issued by this court on contract interpretation becomes a matter of de novo review. And I don't think there's any question that there was no hearing on credibility. There were no live witnesses. These were declarations that were submitted. And the court's determination wasn't this was just a term sheet. It was it's inadmissible under 1119, and it's not subject to the exception in 1123B.
Let me ask you this. There is a well-recognized favorable policy of the law that favors mediation and settlement. Doesn't the position that you take run contrary to that?
No. In fact, all three policies that are at issue in this case, confidentiality and mediation, settlement and arbitration, favor an outcome in favor of my client, even if you don't adopt the reasoning that just the arbitration clause causes it to be words to that effect. Let me explain why. Nothing about the issue that was put in front of the trial court in the settlement terms agreement signed by all the parties and the mediator exposes what happened during the mediation, required evidence of communications, put forth any party's position, or exposed materials that were prepared just for mediation. It was a matter of contract interpretation to enforce a settlement agreement. And when the parties reach a settlement, and their lawyers tell the lower court, we've reached a settlement, and they extract a benefit from the lower court in terms of a continuance and in terms of not having to respond to discovery, that means they have entered into a settlement agreement that should be enforced.
But aren't they going to be loath to put their signatures to term sheets or other preliminary documents if they feel that there will be no confidentiality, and there may be still outstanding issues such as the tax issues in this case.
Well, first of all, the tax issues were a matter that was expressly discussed in the written settlement terms. They would give us their cooperation, and that's all. If it was unresolved, the agreement stands on its own and people accept the tax consequences.
Counsel, suppose all we had in this case was the written document itself signed by the parties. And the only thing following that was a position taken by one party that he doesn't consider it to be a binding agreement. Would your position still be the same?
Yes, it would.
And
you know,
why?
The courts have...
Where are the binding words in that document?
In the document that we have here, all the words, including that the parties will grant mutual releases, that there's no community property, that the amount of money, when it would be paid, and the ultimate expression being... any and all disputes, any and all, not just in the future, not just in the written agreement, but beginning today, any and all disputes subject to JAMS arbitration rules. That is a separately enforceable arbitration agreement, an inch above the party's signature, that deserves to be enforced independently under 1281.2 of the Code of Civil Procedure. And that's a separate issue from 1123.
It's only enforceable if the document's admissible, right?
It's enforceable because 1281.2 says it's enforceable. The statute says an agreement to arbitrate signed by the parties is enforceable as a matter of law. Now, I will grant you that no court has attempted to harmonize 1123B and 1281.2 in terms of how do you deal with this. An arbitration agreement signed by the parties is enforceable as a matter of law, but 1123B raises a question of evidentiary admissibility. Well, you don't have to struggle with this, in my opinion, because for years this court has adopted the severability doctrine. And the severability doctrine says if a challenge is not made to the arbitration clause itself, and it's to the entire document, that's for the arbitrators.
So what we should do here is say, well, the parties agreed to arbitrate. We know that much. We have no idea what the rest of the agreement is because, of course, it's being severed and is inadmissible. So now that you've spent 2 days in mediation and represented to the court that you have a settlement, go off to the arbitrator, won't you, and figure out what you agreed on?
Let the arbitrator decide whether it's enforceable, what the terms are, and let the arbitrator decide if it's admissible. That is the traditional arbitration outcome that the Supreme Court in Prima Paint said, and then this court in Erickson versus Arbuthnot said, even in fraud in the inducement. Now, they didn't claim they were fraudulently induced to sign this agreement, but had they said they were fraudulently induced to sign this agreement, and somebody, let's say somebody had said to them, oh, this is just a term sheet, even though we're going through the formality of having every single person and the mediator sign it, let's say they said we were fraudulently induced. Under Erickson versus Arbuthnot, that's an issue for the arbitrator to decide.
Well, I think I'd like to just clarify the point that you just made. Let's assume, contrary to your argument, that you do agree it was a term sheet, and let's assume that that term sheet had the arbitration provision we're talking about. Is it your position that being the case, it becomes, all of the term sheet becomes an enforceable and binding agreement?
There is a severable and enforceable arbitration agreement that's not conditional on a future agreement. It says any and all disputes subject to JAMS arbitration.
So your position is severability.
That's one of our positions.
And that's your fallback. And the Court of Appeal, however, held that, as I understand it, that the very phrase that any and all disputes are subject to arbitration shows that this term sheet, as one side would have it, this agreement as you would have it, was intended to be, the entirety was intended to be binding and enforceable.
And I agree with that position as well, although that could have been a position that an arbitrator could have reached.
All right, I understand your position, but I want to ask you about something that Mr. Sharch has said, to the effect that if we were to uphold the Court of Appeal, when you're working on these term sheets, arbitration perhaps is one of the easiest things you can get the parties to agree, but if we were to affirm the Court of Appeal, the attorney would never put that in the early mediating stages, that everything's going to be subject to arbitration. That's
a question of pure speculation. The parties are, it is an important signature of enforceability when everybody signs an agreement. That's been the law in California for dozens of years, that the first evidence of... Yes.
I would be inclined to agree with you. If everybody signs it, let's just all go home. But that's not what the statute says.
So we come down to, in that question, what are words to that effect? Okay. Do you take the fourth grade workbook approach that there's certain vocabulary words, and if you don't find them in the text, you fail? Or do you say that a court can engage in a normal type of contract interpretation looking at the entire agreement? The Court of Appeal looked at the entire agreement and said every provision, confidentiality, mutual releases, community property, payment amount, payment date, tax treatment are all addressed in this agreement, and that's evidence with the ultimate expression of enforceability being the arbitration clause.
Hasn't the legislature, through the specific provision of the statute, made the judgment call that this is not subject to normal contract principles? In other words, as I read the statute, the legislature is in effect saying the parties to mediation should be able to lay it all out and to speak freely and to make every effort to move forward to it without any type of threat that what they do before they ultimately sign off as a binding agreement is not going to come back to haunt them.
Well, the I agree with you as to the legislature's intent in 1119, which the court has construed on a couple occasions. The legislative history for 1123 says, from the Law Revision Commission in 1997, says there is a, quote, likelihood that the parties will not use terms like admissible, enforceable, or binding. So we're putting in this phrase to expand the universe of enforceable agreements, not restrict them. And the two courts that have considered that language, the Stewart case, which was in our supplemental brief, and our case, both said those words are intended to be expansive, not restrictive. And the reason is that enforcing mediated settlements is the ultimate purpose of mediation. If you let people do what they did in this case, sign an agreement, circulate a settlement agreement that confirms it, go to open court and say we've reached a settlement agreement, you undermine mediation. Because people walking out of mediation won't have any assurance that they've done anything good. It completely undermines the process.
Sorry for interrupting you, but you may be running out of time very quickly. And I'm getting back to an initial question I asked because, and I want the opposing side to give me a response to this question. I indicated to you earlier, as I did to the opposing side, three requirements. Written settlement agreement signed by the parties. As to signed by the parties, there's no dispute about it. All of you signed. Number three, I indicated to you at first glance, I tend to agree with the Court of Appeal that, yes, the inclusion of the arbitration provision does meet the third requirement of the statute. Here is where my focus is at this point. The Court of Appeal, instead of focusing on the first agreement, whether there was a written settlement agreement, for some reason, unexplained in its decision, focused on the third requirement, which, at least at this point, seems a wee bit illogical to me, but of course I'm just pursuing this in the course of oral argument and I may change my mind later. On the first, so after it agreed with you that the third agreement had been met, then it went to the first agreement, and then the Court of Appeals said, oh, by the way, we apply a de novo standard, and of course, since you won in the Court of Appeal, when I asked the question, you said this court has to apply a de novo standard, and this is where, at this point, I disagree. Well, so while I'm with you on the third point, from my standpoint, for tentative purposes of oral argument, you have a huge hurdle with respect to the first element, because it appears to me that a court of appeal, and you as a consequence, because you gave the same answer to me, that this court has to apply de novo review, that the court of appeal erred in applying a standard of de novo review. And let me, or I'll try to explain to you why. When the existence or meaning of a term in a contract turns on extrinsic facts that, as here, are very much in dispute, then the appropriate standard is not de novo review, but substantial evidence. And as I indicated earlier, on that first point, the trial court, based upon disputed factual issues, and I know you disagreed with me and you said, no, this is a question of law. I disagree with you. Here there was a conflict pertaining to the conduct of the parties before and after the signing of the agreement, and as I see it, on that first issue, that may be a point where, for tentative purposes, I think the other side may have a better argument that this court is bound, or that this court should resolve the issue based upon substantial evidence, given the trial court's determination.
Let me address that. First of all, in looking at the order that was entered below and the evidence in front of it, I don't think the court made a factual finding to that effect. The question that you asked is, what about the Court of Appeal? Well, I think if you have your clerks or you take a look at the briefing below, you will see that the petitioners here did not contest item one, assigned settlement agreement. They focused their attention on the question of words to that effect. You'll see nothing in the briefs that said we didn't meet the first criteria or that it was signed. This is something that in the four corners purports to be settlement terms. Now, it doesn't use the word settlement agreement, but if you look at the four corners of it, and the interpretation of this should be a matter of law, the parties will sign mutual releases and dismiss with prejudice all claims. Amount of settlement will be confidential. All sides bear their own attorney's fees and costs. Mary Ann Fair disclaims any community property interest. Defendants will not look to Fair for reimbursement of phantom income. This could not be more detailed as to the material terms of an agreement.
So when you reached when you returned to court and said, we've reached a settlement agreement, did you put that settlement agreement on the record?
The settlement agreement that Mr.
Did you put that settlement agreement on the record?
No, we did not at that point.
Why not?
Because the parties were circulating a more detailed, written, comprehensive
because
agreement.
Because the details of the terms of the settlement had not yet been agreed to?
No, totally consistent. If you look at, in the record, the Court of Appeals cited to the settlement terms that were circulated by the defendants below themselves and found it to be completely consistent, even saying in what they said, this case is settled as of March 20th, being the mediation date.
And I ask you the same question.
Yes.
If the details to the settlement have been so settled up to that point in time, why did you not put it on the record?
Because that wasn't the issue in front of the court. We weren't there to record the settlement. We were there on a trial setting conference.
Well, there's an old maxim about the devil being in the details, isn't there? And isn't that really applicable? I mean, that can put the kibosh.
Well, there's also an old saying that you can't say one thing to a court and gain a benefit, and then when it's expedient, change your mind and take a different position. These people went in front of the trial judge with us there and said, we've reached a settlement agreement. And we all knew what it was. It was right here in the term sheet. And aren't they bound by what they tell a trial court when they ask for relief?
Well, at the moment, we're talking about the admissibility of a document.
Right.
Because if the document's not admissible, everything else is background noise. And the legislature could have said, these things are admissible if the parties say they're admissible, or they say it's a final agreement, or if the totality of the document gives rise to a reasonable interpretation that it's a final agreement and everybody would know it if you read it. But they didn't say that. They said it either has to say that it's final, binding, or admissible, or words to that effect. So what's wrong with an interpretation of that statute that says if you want this document that you have hammered out over 2 days or 2 weeks in a hotly contested mediation, say so. Say this is an agreement that we all plan on being bound by, or this is admissible, or this is coming in, or, you know.
If you want to create a gotcha for people who want to renege, you can adopt that interpretation, or you can follow the legislative history, which says there's a likelihood that people will not do it. Remember, mediations are conducted in a variety of circumstances with a variety of different parties. Imagine if it was a religious mediation and there were words that said, you know, under the authority of heaven, and they signed. And wouldn't you want to know if in that religious sect, under authority of heaven, meant a binding agreement? Of course you would. If they put that right above their signatures and they were a religious sect mediating and signing, you'd want to know that that religious sect considers those words to be enforceable and binding. The arbitration agreement here was the ultimate expression of the settlement and the intent to be enforceable. It was the ninth term. It was right above the party's signature, and it wasn't expressed in any conditional sense, any future sense. It was in the present sense. Any and all disputes subject to JAMS arbitration rules. And what happened here is nothing but settlers' remorse and the attempt to use that statute to renege. And, you know, what's interesting is Mr. Dyer, who made the representation in court that I referred to, Mr. Newcomb, who made the representation in writing to the court that I referred to, they never submitted a declaration saying it wasn't binding. They never appeared in court and disputed their statements. You won't find anything in the record where these attorneys who stood in front of the court and said the case had settled a month after the mediation ever said, I was mistaken, I didn't mean it. What happened was they brought in new lawyers to take that position.
So under your analysis, when the court is confronted with the question of evidentiary admissibility, it should have a 402 hearing at which it receives all kinds of extrinsic evidence on what the document really, really meant and what they really, really thought and whether or not the players have changed and all that before the court can rule on whether or not a document, which should be clear in its face, is admissible?
You start with the four corners of the document, and if you need extrinsic evidence, you can look at extrinsic evidence that's consistent with the interpretation.
But
remember,
you only do that if you find that there's an ambiguity in the document.
That's correct.
Well, where's the ambiguity here? You're saying it's as clear as crystal.
Well, and so did the Court of Appeal, and I don't think they needed to look farther in this case, although they could have.
Well, but why are we hearing all this stuff about what happened later?
Well, because there's an estoppel issue here about people who come into here saying, well, maybe the mediator was just pushing us forward on nine terms that it agreed to, and maybe there were five others that hadn't been agreed to. That's ridiculous. It's contrary to the record. It's contrary to representations made in open court, and the court should allow or hold lawyers and parties to those kind of representations in open court. They should not be able to get away with changing counsel, changing positions, and then relying on 1123B. And I want to just reiterate, this was a motion to compel arbitration. This was not a motion to enforce the settlement or to collect the money or to get a judgment. It was a motion to take the issues that the parties had between them and refer them to an arbitrator. The arbitrator, under the JAMS rules, was given the authority to determine admissibility, enforceability, and so on. So that was the only issue before the court. And clearly, the arbitration agreement stands alone and should have been enforced. And the rest of these issues that we've been debating, if you want to get to them, obviously under 1123B, that's how you phrased your issue, you can get to them. But in reality, under the severability doctrine, those questions could have gone to the arbitrator. And we would have been done with this case not 4 years later standing here, but a few months later.
Apart from severability, getting back to the term, the phrase, term sheet, what is the significance then in the trial court's characterization of this document as a term sheet? And we heard from opposing counsel that a term sheet is commonly used in real estate transactions. My question to you is, when there is a mediation proceeding going on in some real estate transaction, do parties commonly sign off on term sheets?
No.
Although
I mean, this is
although
a
your time is up, you may respond to Justice Kennard's question.
Right. This whole issue that people in mediations sign written partial term sheets to move on to the second term is just a fiction. It's nowhere in the record. It's nowhere in the authorities. When people sign an agreement, that's an important act. They're signing an agreement. Now, in some real estate transactions, people sign a term sheet, but you know what it says? It says this is not binding until a written agreement is signed by all the parties. That's the real history in real estate transactions, is a term sheet is not binding when it says it's not binding. Otherwise, if it has all the material terms in it and it's signed by the parties, it is binding. But
thank you, Mr. Sirota.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schartzes. And you may argue in rebuttal.
That last issue pertaining to term sheet, because I find myself listening to one part of the argument, then listening to the other part of the opposing side's argument, and I am focused on the trial court's finding of term sheet. You told us, yeah, a term sheet is just something that people in real estate transactions ordinarily fill out. And my question to Mrs. Sirota was, well, do people in mediation proceedings commonly sign off on term sheets? And the answer was, I think, no. So what about the significance of the trial court's finding that the document at issue was a term sheet? Because when I initially looked at it, I thought, well, I agree on the third point with the Court of Appeal. I found it illogical that a Court of Appeal, instead of going to the first point, written agreement, it started off with the third point. But then I thought, your side, Mr. Sarkis. From my standpoint, you have a good point then, based upon the trial court's finding of term sheets. And now, after listening to both oral arguments, I think it's all up for grabs.
All right, so let me try to put it on my side of the line. Term sheets are not just limited to real estate transactions. That was just an example. They're used throughout the business community. They're used in securities transactions. They're used in business transactions. They're widespread practice. 1123, because it talks about documents being signed by all the parties in a mediation, and then has additional requirements for those to be disclosable or admissible, clearly contemplates that parties will do exactly what they did here. If not, 1123 would not have the signature
but
requirement.
But is it your view that with respect to the trial court's term sheet finding, would it be proper to then say implicit in that finding is the determination by the trial court that there was no binding contract based simply on the use of term sheet. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Let me address that directly. The trial court is the finder of fact. The trial court had before it in this case declarations by both sides. The parties on one side, the lawyers on the other. The lawyers had declarations about what had happened in the mediation, which the court said was inadmissible because it was improper. And there was also the record of what had happened in the trial court with the reporting that not just that it had settled, but that we are preparing settlement agreements. At page 4 of the DCA's opinion, they indicate in plain language that the court said, quote, if it's settled, close quote. That's what the trial court said when the trial court heard the presentations by the very lawyers, and you can find it on page 4 of the opinion. If it's settled, suggesting it was not settled, and that the court understood it, as Yogi Berra would say, it ain't over until it's over. They had to, and they were exchanging settlement agreements, documents that didn't agree with each other. One had one set of terms that one party didn't like, and vice versa. So they were in that process of settling. There was ample evidence for any superior court, if it needed to conclude that there was no settlement and that it was a term sheet.
Almost by definition, if there are significant tax issues that are unresolved, there isn't a final agreement.
Not only that, Your Honor, they couldn't agree on consideration. It was Blackacre and Whiteacre. It was the Peerless Ship and the Peerless Ship. One thought certain things were included in the settlement. One thought certain things were not included in the settlement. That's not reneging. That's disagreement. And that's what we had in this case. And I'm going to take a try, Justice Kennard, at bringing you around on the third point. The third point, which is what the Court of Appeal did, it said that an arbitration provision in a document is the equivalent of saying it's enforceable and binding. But the plaintiff himself, in his brief at page 22, wrote, "The Court of Appeal opinion should not be read as establishing a universal rule that any arbitration provision included in any mediation settlement document will always render the settlement agreement admissible under 1123. Therefore, it is not clearly words to the effect, because if it were, it would always render something admissible."
What about his argument that there are other statutory provisions that call for the enforceability of arbitration agreements? This is an arbitration agreement. Just send us to arbitration.
I'm delighted you asked that, because the evidence code 1119 says that any writing in a mediation is inadmissible unless there is a statutory exception for admissibility. So for the purposes of the superior court, a statement that says go to arbitration doesn't exist. It's not admissible. It's
so
not evidence.
So it's no more admissible than, well, but he would suggest, well, just sever that off.
Right. And it's a wonderful concept. You erase the 8 prior points in the term sheet. You admit into superior court item 9 that says subject to arbitration. All of us go and we have our meeting with the arbitrator. The arbitrator looks at us and says, well, what are you here for? One side says, we want you to determine what we settled. And the other side says, we can't tell you what we did. And neither can they. It all happened in a mediation. Oral statements and written statements in a mediation are not admissible in an arbitration under 1119. And you, Mr. Arbitrator, must guess at what happened in the mediation and impose upon us the terms of settlement. I'm sorry, we only have this one sentence to go by.
So when your opponent urges that the question of admissibility would then be determined by the arbitrator to obviate perhaps the problem you suggest, you would reply that that begs the question. The whole point is whether or not this is admissible in the first place, whether it's admissible in a court of law or admissible in arbitration.
Absolutely. However, under Rosenthal, Banner Entertainment, Architects and Engineers, it is the superior court which must determine whether something goes to arbitration to begin with. And it gets back to Justice Kennard's point, which is, what can the superior court look at to make that determination if it needs to? Clearly, it's a substantial evidence rule. There was ample evidence in this case about what the parties did, although a lot of it was inadmissible. The Superior Court reached a decision, and that's subject to a substantial evidence test. And that is something that the Court of Appeal failed to look at. But that's where you would get. There's no question how the structure works, what causes something to be arbitrable, who makes that decision, what they look at, what's admissible. And then finally,
from your standpoint, the Court of Appeal went astray when it applied the de novo standard. What it should have applied was a substantial evidence standard.
I believe that's right. I believe that's right. Well, let me just wrap up and see if there are...
One last question, Mr. Schreitzes.
I'm sorry.
One last question. You keep referring to a term sheet, but the mediation confidentiality statute extends beyond term sheets,
yes.
Does it not? It extends to settlement agreements.
Yes. I agree with that, Your Honor. And in fact, it's our position it wasn't a settlement agreement at all to begin with. It was an attempt to use paragraph 9, the arbitration provision, to leverage this into argue that it was a settlement agreement and then attempt to have it admitted. But if the history of the briefing shows that the whole argument in this case was not the admissibility under the portion of that I hope I persuaded Justice Kennard on. That wasn't the issue the plaintiffs raised. They raised the competing policy issues between arbitration and mediation. Arbitration is more important than mediation, therefore we just take it to arbitration and we run roughshod over the statute and over what the legislature has told us we cannot do. If there are no further questions, I submit the case.
All right. Apparently none. Thank you, Mr. Schreitzes. Thank you, Mr. Sirota. The matter stands submitted.